Hey guys, what's going on? It's me, William the Opinion Updike. I'm here with Locked On Clippers, part of the Locked On NBA Network. I'm coming at you today with a solo cast. Our dear departed friend Charles Mockler is out celebrating his birthday, so if you haven't already, give him a happy birthday. Give him, I don't know, some money or something? Or nothing, you know? That's always the best gift. You can't get anything wrong. So I'm coming at you with a solo episode. As you know, today is Friday. Every Friday, Charles and I do a Pacific Division power ranking of some kind. Today, we're going to take a look at the best shooting teams in the Pacific Division. There were some interesting things in there, some interesting things to note, so I'm going to be breaking that down. And then, as always, everybody's favorite Friday segment, Love, Marry, Kill. I got a fun one for you today in honor of Patrick Patterson signing, which is what I'm going to actually kick off the podcast with today. Talk a little bit about that and maybe some ideas for what we should do with that last roster spot. I've got a couple of different scenarios for you guys, so stay tuned for all of that and more coming up right about now. All right, so it was announced yesterday that we signed Patrick Patterson for a $2.3 million deal with the Clips. If you listen to the show often, you have probably heard me talk about this when it was still speculative. I wasn't really a big fan of the idea. I just didn't really see a huge amount of value that would be added to the team. That being said, though, if I think about it more as an 82-game move, it kind of makes sense to me a little bit more. I don't know off the bat how much action Patrick Patterson would be seeing in the playoffs, but from the standpoint of a season being really long and unpredictable, it does make sense to have another sort of wing front court guy who can fill in any gaps. And obviously his offense is going to be, I mean, almost non-existent, very, very low. However, on any unit that he plays with as on the currently constructed Clippers, that's not really going to be an issue. So my biggest knock on him is kind of null and void. In a vacuum, you know, that would be a worry, but both units, even with Paul George still recovering, that first unit will still have Kawhi, Landry Shamet, JaMychal Green. So that's pretty shored up if he was to spend any time with the first unit. However, I do see his most likely fit being with the second unit, possibly even as a third runner-up guy. I think that it's a great addition in that it adds a little bit more defensive value, which in turn can help alleviate some of the burden on guys that are going to be a little bit higher usage on that second unit. You know, we've often talked, especially recently, about some of Trez's defensive shortcomings. For as great as he is in a lot of areas, there can be some shortcomings there, and I do feel like Patrick Patterson could maybe help alleviate some of those issues. So let's just break down Patterson a little bit by the numbers. As I said, offensively, nothing really to get too excited about. He averaged 4-2-1 last year. He shot 37% from the field, 34% from three, which is actually better than I thought it was. He's not at those Mo Harkless numbers, and only 63% from the line, which I think is atrocious, but, you know, what are you going to do? He's probably not getting the line that much. So I think that this is pretty interesting. Just thinking about the ability to move him around on that second unit. And when I say second unit, I'm using this term a little bit loosely because you can look at it two ways. Obviously, there's the second unit that is the five guys that are the designated kind of second unit. But if you think of it in more of like a fluid pattern, which I do think that this team is gonna look like this year, you just have a lot of ability with Patrick Patterson to move JaMychal Green up a position and play a little bit bigger. You can have Mo Harkless and Patterson out there, which will cover up for any defensive holes that there might be between Lou Williams and Landry Shamet or Rodney Magruder, and Trez, obviously, as I mentioned earlier. So I think overall, to me, it's an 8. Like, I don't know how else to explain it other than it's an 82 game move, roster wise. It's, you know, this isn't looking for like the highest ceiling player. This is looking for some form of consistency, somebody that you know what you're going to get. It's a very Clippers signing in that way. Patterson is, you know, kind of a defined tool in what he is, and we pretty much know what his role is going to be in this unit. But that kind of got me thinking, what do we do with our last roster spot? I had said on this podcast previously that I kind of thought we were going to stand pat. However, that didn't happen. So I wonder who we're eyeing for that 15th man. I think the fans have a lot of their own ideas. I haven't heard anything too official yet, but I put together a couple scenarios kind of based on, you know, what Charles and I have been looking at as possible holes in the Clippers' current roster construction, as well as things that, you know, you guys as fans and stuff will send into us on a pretty regular basis. So I think the most popular option for the last roster spot is people want Iguodala. Obviously, there's a little bit of a complication there with him being with Memphis, and it seems like they are really hesitant to buy him out. I guess they don't want to take too much of a loss on that and then, you know, give him up to most likely a Western Conference competitor. So do understand that. But in the scenario that he does, he does end up getting bought out and we're able to retain him. He did average 6-4-3 last season, pretty solid splits, 50% from the field, 33% three-point shooter. So that's all really solid stuff. I guess my biggest concern, if we were to go this route, is just the age and the miles. I don't think that you can ever have too many wings in the modern NBA. I think that was one of my biggest criticisms of the roster last year. And now we have like this wealth of kind of switchy wing players. So adding Iguodala, I think, it makes a lot of sense. It fits in with this team. He's got a lot of veteran experience. However, he is 35 years old. And in all of his years of play, his career average is over 30 minutes a game. Last season, he was still playing, 26, 28 minutes. And I do realize that he was out for a swath of time for injury. He was most likely playing injured through the playoffs. But that's a lot. That's a lot to bear. And just looking at his numbers compared to some wings that we already have, we don't have anybody who's, other than Jamichael Green on paper, as defensively strong as him. Just looking at their defensive ratings, they're identical. But I think that that's one of the flaws in the stat. I would say that, to the eye test, Iguodala is a sort of better, more consistent defender. Mo Harkless is right around there. I would say that he's better and has more upside. However, Iguodala does have a somewhat more consistent offensive game than him. But I don't know. I don't think that he's an upgrade, obviously, from Mo. So once again, it becomes a thing of like, if you have better players that you can play in a playoff scenario, what are you willing to give up for another kind of 82-game guy? With Iguodala especially, I mean, he has a lot of cachet. He carries a lot of cachet in this league. Obviously, it's all very deserved. Finals MVP, great team guy, great locker room guy, great leader. But we're a team that already has a lot of leaders and great locker room guys. So I think that this move, if this were to happen, it would be a little bit perplexing to me. I like the idea. Obviously, Iguodala is a huge net positive, but I don't see him defensively being able to, through an 82-game season, provide a higher defensive upside than Mo Harkless. And, Harkless has playoff experience too. And, I just think that I think that defensively, he has a little bit more to offer in terms of how young he is at only 26, and just his physical frame and size and just so many less miles. I think he would really have to shit the bed for him to not be in the playoff rotation. So I know that people are really high on the idea of Iggy, but if we let him slip to the Lakers, it wouldn't be a move that I would really regret that much. So that's all I really have for the Iguodala scenario. Obviously, it seems pretty unlikely, but if it were to happen, I mean, I think that Iguodala is a good player. I still just don't really see the fit. We have kind of better wing guys. And so that leads directly into scenario two, which is I think the position we most need to address, and that would be a center. So couple of names kind of floating around. Joakim Noah, who we've talked about a ton on this podcast, but he had a great season last year with the Grizzlies. He averaged 7-6-2 in only 17 minutes a game. So I think that would be really positive. I mean, that would be, if he could, you know, put up similar numbers without a regression, I mean, that would really be all that we would need out of Noah. I also like the idea of just having one more traditional size guy, just depending on the lineup that you're going against. I mean, if you look at the Lakers, obviously they have, you know, they have JaVale in their back pocket. And, you know, with DeMarcus's injury, we don't know what else they're going to do at that center position. And then just looking at some of the more athletic centers, Willie Cauley-Stein, who I think Zubats could match up with, but it wouldn't be a bad idea to me to have a backup of like a more traditional kind of center build. He was a net positive. Noah had an offensive rating of 113, a defensive rating of 105, which is, you know, far above average. And you could argue that the sample size was lower, and of course it is, you know, a lot of minutes against B squads. But, you know, he torched us one game, and I don't know. Stuff like that kind of sticks out to me. So I think that he's definitely got something left in the tank, and I think that he could contribute both through an 82-game season. You know, I hope that some of his injury stuff is behind him, especially with a lower usage rate. And then I think he could contribute in the playoffs too. I think that he's hungry for an opportunity like that. I was really struck by, and this isn't a stat or anything at all, but just how like humble he was in accepting his role last year. And I don't know. I think that makes him a good fit for this team. Another guy that we're looking at center, who we haven't really talked about much on this podcast, and I'm frankly kind of surprised that he's not on a squad yet, is Kenneth Faried. Last year with the Rockets, he averaged 10-7-1, which is really solid. And then what's interesting about him is he can space the floor a little bit. He shoots the three at like 33%. Now, that's on low attempts. It's only on like one a game. But if the threat is there, it doesn't even have to be necessarily from three. If he can space the floor at all, I think that just opens things up more for Trez on the second unit. So I think that he's an interesting fit. He, like I said, he had a great season last year. He had an offensive rating of 126, defensive rating of 109. So you don't run across a lot of plus 17 guys. I guess the biggest drawback to me for Faried is we're looking at somebody who's kind of another tweener. He's only like, he's like 6'8", 6'10", right around that kind of Trez range. He does, you know, like I said, he does space the floor a little bit more, which could be desirable, especially if JaMychal Green is seeing a lot of minutes with the first unit. I think that having another center who can kind of space the floor would be good. Once again, it's just still remains to be seen the growth that we're going to see from Zubats. Those to me seem like the two most likely candidates. Dwight Howard, who we've talked about a lot, is still kind of in purgatory with Memphis, so I'm not really sure what's going to end up happening with that. It's kind of weird that Memphis is like dangling the keys of like some of the most enticing free agents remaining. This is something that they do every year. They have like the guy that everybody wants at the trade deadline. Last year was Tyreke Evans. Before, you know, take your pick of Gasol or Conley, and they just never trade them in a timely manner. So yeah, that's all I really have for centers. Let me know what you guys think. What would you like to see done with this 15th roster spot? Is there anybody out there that you think I slept on? I'd love to know what everyone else in Clipper Nation is thinking. So that does it for this first segment. Patterson signing, great. We're all thrilled. Coming up next, I'm going to be talking about the best shooting teams in the Pacific Division. So stay tuned for that. All right, so I'm back. And I was kind of wondering about just like the best marksman in the Pacific Division. Obviously a lot of great shooters out there, but I think it's worth noting the teams that provide a little bit more spacing. So I took a look at both field goal percentage, which I know can be skewed, as well as the three-point percentage. And I took numbers from last year, which for a couple of these squads isn't really quite fair, but I will denote that, and I'll talk a little bit about some of those other players. So let's just get into it. So to me, the last place shooting team in the Pacific Division is probably the Suns. They had a 46% field goal percentage, 33% three-point percentage, and they tied for the worst three-point percentage in the division. Really not great. I think this number of their three-point percentage could even go down. They traded away TJ Warren, who was an excellent shooter, excellent scorer. Man, the Suns, everything they do perplexes me. So most notable guys, as far as like floor spacers and scorers that you got out there, obviously Devin Booker, who isn't like an elite three-point shooter. He knocks him down at a 33% clip. It's on about 7 attempts a game, though, so you know that he's going to knock down a few. Interestingly enough, I was just looking for comparisons for his numbers. He actually takes less three-point attempts a game than Jamichael Green and has a lower percentage. So, man, way to go, Jamichael Green. This podcast might just turn into a Jamichael Green appreciation podcast. I love the dude. I think that was such a great signing. Anyways, I could just wax intellectual about Jamichael Green all day, but I'll get back to this. So without TJ Warren, there's not a whole lot out there shooting-wise. I think the next guy who can kind of space the floor and be a threat would be Kelly Oubre. I would note that he is like a highly streaky shooter, but you know, it's something that could improve. I think that he can add value in that area, but man, overall, The Suns. I feel bad. I almost think that we should start making these Pacific Division rankings just 1 through 4, and maybe not even invite the Suns to the party. So that takes me to our fourth place best shooting team in the Pacific Division, which is, to me, I think is the Lakers. So let me tell you why. Last year, they posted a 47% field goal percentage, which, you know, fine. They tied for the worst three-point percentage in the division at 33%. So these numbers, I think, are going to see a boost just with the addition of Danny Green. Maybe you get something out of some of the other guys. Maybe other people improve, obviously. Let's just talk about Anthony Davis, because his three-point shooting, to me, is like a little bit, the way people talk about it is maybe, I think it's maybe a little overrated or a bit bloated of a stat. So Anthony Davis shoots on splits of 52% from the field, you know, which is great, 33% from three, which is fine, and he's an 80% free throw shooter, which is great. But that 33% from three is only on three attempts a game. So he's making like one a game, statistically, and so I don't see that as being like a super elite floor spacer. Obviously, he can score from a lot of angles, so I'm curious to see how that's going to work out in this Lakers offense, especially if LeBron is going to be running the point. I'm curious to see ways that they're going to find Anthony Davis. I know that LeBron isn't going to be like running the point, but in clutch situations when he most likely has the ball in his hands, I'm curious to see where he's going to be looking for Davis, because I don't think it's going to be, I mean, I don't think it's going to be from outside. I don't think that in a pressure time situation, you're trying to get the last shot to Anthony Davis. It just doesn't really make sense to me. So Danny Green, probably the best three-point shooter for the Lakers. He has splits of 47% from the field, 46% from three, which is mind-boggling to me that they're like almost identical, and 84% from the line. I don't know. What can be said? Danny Green is really clutch. He can be extremely streaky. I think in like a playoff series, you're looking at, I don't know. You're looking at depending on how long the series goes, you're looking at least two or three slump games from Danny Green. So that being said, though, I think you still got to respect him from three. And he can space the floor. He also adds some really, really solid defense. So he definitely does raise the ceiling for the Lakers as shooters. And then we'll just talk briefly about LeBron. Maybe you've heard of this guy before. He 51% from the field, elite. 34% three-point shooter. Something interesting to note. I feel like maybe we don't typically think of LeBron as like a shooter. But he has... he has a decent percentage, and he has increased. He's increased his three-point attempts every year except for, I think, like his 13-14 season in Cleveland. No, not 13-14 in Cleveland. Anyways, before he had a weird number of attempts that was kind of an outlier in his last year in Cleveland, I believe. Yeah, his last year in Cleveland, the 9-10 season, he attempted 5 threes a game, which is the highest number he posted until the 17-18 season, his last year in Cleveland. And then last year with the Lakers, highest mark of his career in attempts, he was at 5.9, so right around that 6 mark. I'm curious to see how we see that moving forward. I think that if he can maintain or improve that 34% from three, I think that it's gonna just help his transition as he gets a little bit older. It'd be really interesting to see him like adding more of a like a three off the dribble, maybe a step back. That'd be such an interesting move. But anyways, that's the Lakers. To me, yeah, they're the fourth best shooting team in the Pacific Division. Number three, I got our little infatuation team, which is the Sacramento Kings. Last year, they shot 46% from the field, 38% from three, and they just have some really pretty solid dudes, obviously. I'll talk about Fox. He shot about 37%. I think that his number could go up. He improved as a shooter just hand over fist from his first year. I really think that he should have been a stronger candidate for most improved player. But I think that he could possibly improve that number. Obviously, with his speed and finishing ability, you know, A lot of his field goals are going to be from two. So, you know, maybe he's not a floor spacer in the traditional sense of the word, but he is a threat, and he is a guy that, you know, defenses can't really slag off of. And then you got Buddy Hield, dead-eye shooter, another guy who just improved so much. So, yeah, the Kings are pretty solid. And then, you know, we talk about Harrison Barnes, pretty solid, you know, solid shooter from three. From the field, he can be a little bit inconsistent. I mean, that carries over to three as well. But, you know, still, he'll get a high number of looks. And, you know, some amount of them have to fall in. So he does add a little bit of dynamicism to their offense, which, you know, you can never have enough of. So it takes me to our number two in the best shooters of the Pacific Division. You got your LA Clippers, baby. So... last year, we posted numbers of 40% from the field and 39% actually from three. We were incredibly, incredibly accurate from three-point range. We were just very low in attempts. So that's why That's why I wouldn't put us at the best as the best shooting team in the Pacific Division, just because, well, you know who's ahead of them at this point, and they just have a higher volume. So looking at some key guys who are going to be spacing the floor for the Clippers, I've just kind of been thinking about the beginning of the season, just A, because it's coming up so soon, and because we won't have Paul George, who is obviously a great three-point shooter, high volume, still very efficient. But I'm thinking in the starting lineup, the two guys that are going to be responsible for spacing the floor a lot, it's going to be Landry Shamet, obviously, and Jamichael Green. Jamichael Green, I've already talked about it. I've already hammered down enough Jamichael Green love, but he shot 40% from three on almost seven attempts a game. I think he was at like 6.5 attempts a game. And I'm curious to see what happens with that number. I think that it's just really going to depend on how they fit everybody in. But I would see the starting lineup, as I'm predicting these best shooting teams, as most likely being Patrick Beverley, Landry Shamet at the two, Kawhi at his natural kind of small forward position, Jamichael Green at the four, and then most likely Zubats rounding out the center position for that starting lineup. And you know, Kawhi, I didn't include him in here because he's, you know, just so much more than a floor spacer. You know, he's an isolation scorer. He can really do a lot of different things. So I wouldn't call him the best shooter, obviously, out of these guys. Landry Shamet broke the record or is second in rookies in terms of three-point percentage on X amount of attempts. So I think that is going to stay consistent. I would be really surprised if there was any sort of drop-off in that, just because, you know, shooters shoot. So it makes sense that would stay pretty consistent. And that takes us to our first, the best shooting team in the Pacific Division, which is obviously the Warriors. Last year, they posted numbers of 49% from the field and 39% from three. Obviously, we tied them in three-point percentage, which is great, but they did take a higher number of attempts. And obviously, you got Steph, what more can be said about Steph? He's like one of the most storied shooters. He, you know, will probably be a leading shooter in the league until he's 80 years old or however long he continues to play. So I want to talk a little bit about D'Angelo Russell, though, as a little bit of a caveat to this sort of ranking as the best. D'Angelo Russell shoots about 37% from three, and my knock on him is that sometimes he takes really inefficient shots. He is a big fan of the Russell Westbrook-esque pull-up transition jumper that's just always going to be a low percentage shot. I think that some of that stuff will probably get ironed out in Steve Kerr's system. I'm really curious to see. He's another guy that I'm curious to see how they use him and how he fits in. Because obviously they're taking a step back with Klay, but I'm still giving them the benefit of the doubt as the best shooting team in the Pacific Division because, you know, like they just have the history and the consistency. So I think D'Angelo Russell, I do think ultimately they'll be able to find a role for him to fill. I'm curious to see what happens when Klay comes back. Do they try to run out all three of those guards? Do they really try to grease the wheels on a D'Angelo Russell trade? I know that was the chatter when they first got that signing in. I really don't know how likely that scenario is. I'd have to think about it some more. I'd have to think about somebody who'd be a really good fit for a point guard that would have something of enough value to give to the Warriors that wouldn't set the team back too much. So that's going to be it for the best shooting teams in the Pacific Division. Next up, I've got a quick love, marry, kill for you, so stay tuned for that. All right, so with the addition of Patrick Patterson, I was kind of wondering about how many more Pats we could possibly accumulate. So today is going to be Love, Marry, Kill, Other Pats, the Clips Should Cop edition. So on the board for Pats, the Clips Should Cop, we've got Patty Mills, guard for the Spurs, great dude. Patrick Ewing, little bit of a throwback, little bit of an oddball choice. Pat Benatar, maybe you've heard of her. Some classic hits. We Belong. Hit me with your best shot. So she's in there. Pat Summitt, also on the board. So initially, I think I'm loving Patty Mills. I don't know what it is. Patty Mills is a guy that I'm just a fan of. I like his game for the role that he plays. I think that on this Clippers squad, it'd be interesting to see him in minutes next to Lou, especially if Landry is playing majority of the time with the starting unit or whatever. I think, yeah, having him in the backcourt adds another kind of little wrinkle as a guy who can handle the ball a little bit, play some defense, and just an all-around good locker room add. So I'm loving you, Patty Mills. Loving it. I'm marrying Pat Summitt. Can you imagine adding Pat Summitt to the team and we have the coaching triple-headed hydra of Doc Rivers, Ty Lue, and Pat freaking Summitt? Arguably one of the best coaches in all of basketball. Pick your league. So huge fan. Almost hit that 1,100 career win mark. Man, led the Lady Vols to a very dominant dynasty. So shout out Pat Summitt. I would love to have you on the team. We could resurrect her, bring her back, and she just ups the Pat factor, which you know I need more of. Which leads me to my kill. I don't really want to kill any of these people. So this isn't a kill so much as it's like a pink slip. They're just more fired than anything else. And I'm firing Patrick Ewing. Like the dude, seems like a good guy. Liked him in those Snickers commercials. But I don't really know what he would add. Maybe he could be cool as like a coach for Zoo. Yeah, I don't know. Nope. Still fired. Can't talk myself into it. But anyways, guys, that's going to do it for me. Thanks for listening so much to another episode of Locked On Clippers. If you haven't already, please subscribe on iTunes. Leave a rating, leave a review. We love it. You can also listen to us on the Himalaya app where you can summit the mountain of pod. Coming up on Monday, your dude, Positive Chuck, will be back with me. We'll be doing the freshies where we kind of take a look at our new guys and we'll discuss anything else that happens between now and then in Clipper Nation. So thanks so much for tuning in, guys. We really appreciate you.